The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. So I'd like to talk to you about Buddha's enlightenment and the story of his life, but mostly when he turned the Dharma wheel with the Four Noble Truths, these Four Noble Truths and these facts of existence within the Four Noble Truths. So we sat yesterday from 12 p.m. to 12 a.m. So just a couple hours ago, it was nice to see the Zendo filled at midnight. And I think a day like this one, celebrating Bodhi Day, is worthy of celebration, that we can hear of the possibility of not just spinning with confusion, reactivity, fathomless separation, that a day that we can celebrate, we don't have to do that, is possible and is celebrated. That amidst the spinning world, there is a profound silence and stillness that's possible. So among the days we mark on the calendar to notice together, this is a good one. This is a good one. We each and all have the inherent possibility to be other than weaselly, but to be more kind than not, to be fundamentally content. And I was reading a book by Punlop Rinpoche called Rebel Buddha. I don't know if any of you have read this. It's great. And he states, what is a rebel Buddha like? It is a renegade that gets you to switch your allegiance from asleep to the awakened state. The mission is to instigate a revolution of mind. A rebel is one who questions, resists, refuses to obey, or rises against the unjust or unreasonable control of authority or traditional Buddha, the awakened mind. So Buddha was, I think, a spiritual rebel. I think Alice in Wonderland was a rebel. We all know rebels. And we know this path that the Buddha took. It's not a quick one for a quick fix for salvation. And if this is what you want, we're always said, turn back. Turn back now. Plug into the matrix. The trance of delusion. Go to it. You know, many teachers say once you start, it's hard to turn from the path. It takes more energy because once we know something and you, as you did this morning, you turned inward and maybe you saw things arising and you could release and go back to your breath. Once we begin to see something and the possibility of that, it's hard to ignore. It takes a lot of energy when something comes to us so true. Buddha was a person, but this awakening also has nothing to do with personal existence. To me, the Buddha is a place of freedom from our crazy mind, from the crazy mind states we get into. That's when we can come out of that. That's Buddha mind. That's Buddha. And this freedom has always been. It has always been with all people, all of us, all beings. All of our hearts already understand this. But the head, our minds have been turned topsy-turvy. and it struggles to keep control over something we can't control. So if we go back to the origins of Siddhartha Gautama, I might call him Sid on occasion. keep saying his name, Siddhartha. Goes back to a brown man across the ocean and how his teachings of the Four Noble Truths are still the truth. Truth is truth. So in actuality, it's all noble. Truth is noble. It's important to know that these truths are just the way things are, and they have nothing to do with the person. They're just truths. The one actually known as Buddha discovered these truths that were already here, that are already truths. He was able to see through the illusion, the dust, the smoke screen. The truths are here the whole time. So, his life, he was born Siddhartha around 567 BCE until he becomes the Buddha after his awakening. And this was in a small town, a small kingdom in the Himalayan foothills. His father was chief of the Sakya clan, and his mother, Maya, died shortly after giving birth to him. And his father married her sister, Mahapajapati, who raised him as, I'm pointing over there because that's an image of Mahapajapati. She's actually standing there. She raised him as her own son, along with two other children that she had later on. And the story goes that 12 years after his birth, before his birth, a sage, an astrologer, possibly a Brahmin fortune teller, had a vision and prophesied that he would either become a universal monarch or a great sage. So he's either going to take over the family business or he was going to go into spirituality. That was the prediction. And they didn't want their son to leave them and become a spiritual master, because spiritual masters don't hang out with their families, much rarely go into the family business. So he was their only son, and they wanted to keep him so he can inherit the family dynasty and become the ruler. So we're in India, and his parents really feared the sage's prediction. So to prevent him from becoming an ascetic, his father kept him within the confines of the palace, secluded and completely shielded from the outside world. Now we can look at our own lives, and maybe something of that has happened to one degree or another, being shielded and kept from the things happening in the world. Some of us may have had that kind of life, such as the Buddha or Gautama. They had three palaces, in all of which he was entertained by dancing girls, instructed by Brahmins, trained in archery, swordsmanship, wrestling, swimming, and running. He was excellent in everything. They provided every princely luxury, bling, rich food, drink, you name it. He had, as some of us might say, everything. But did he? His parents were trying to set up everything so he never saw anyone who was old, aging, sick, never saw death. It's hard to imagine, but some of us may relate. And if he didn't see that, then there would be no risk that he would have to answer any of the big questions of life. or seek answers, or seek a spiritual practice, which was common at that time. He would have no reason to search. And when he became of age, he was in an arranged marriage to Yasodhara, and soon gave birth to a son, Rahula, which is actually translated as fetter. So they named their son Fetter. So the strategy of his parents seemed to work for a while, but there was something poking through Siddhartha Gautama that wasn't sitting very well. Something in this facade was crumbling. Conditions from the past were creeping in and interrupting his so-called happy life. He kept having a memory when he was young. He was about 8 or 9 years old, and his parents were plowing the field, and he was sitting, and he was feeling uneasy, and he decided to sit under a rose apple tree and chill. And it said that he had a spontaneous experience of serenity. He just had a moment where he felt completely at peace. And maybe we've had that too. Maybe when we were young, somewhere, being somewhere, this was a moment of just complete fulfillment, peace. Maybe. Something was rattling him when he came out, and he knew he was not at peace. I remember reading about Octavia Butler, and she was about 3 or 4 years old. She tells the story, and she had a hound dog, and she was petting her hound dog, and they looked at each other directly in the eyes. And she spoke about that moment as a moment of complete peace and understanding of the entire world in that moment. And she never forgot. She just felt nothing needed to be different. And that informed all of her writing from that. As she grew older, she remembered that hit so deeply in her. It rearranged her. I remember a moment like that in sand, sitting on the beach in the sand. I was pretty young, but I just remember there was a moment where all the sounds just fell away, and it was just this very peaceful moment. It was just so complete. And then, of course, a little bit later, things came rushing in again, and I have a whole life ahead of me. That experience is in us. Our heart knows this because we've lived hundreds of thousands of times before. Later, the Buddha called that experience mindful relaxation. And it might be described as that experience of total satisfaction, not needing or wanting anything to be different. Can you imagine? So as life went on, his parents had this agenda to keep their guard on him. And he did occasionally, as I said, go from palace to palace. And his father sent people ahead and went so far as to clear anything that would show up before his carriage came through, so he wouldn't see any of those old age, sickness, or death, or anything unpleasing to the eye. Sounds like the Truman story in a way. Yet it wasn't enough. Something was persistent as his own shadow, and by the time he was in his 20s, he began to feel like a prisoner in his own home, which drew him into wonder and to want to get out beyond the castle walls. So he talked his attendant Chana into getting the horse prepared and taking him out, which Chana did. And one late afternoon, they slipped out, and for the first time in his life, in his 20s, there was no royal escort and no cleanup crew. They went into the streets of Kapilavastu, and he encountered what we know as today as the four simple messengers. There he saw the messenger of sickness, old age, death, and he saw a wandering monastic just walking quietly. These were the four messengers. Nothing in his life of ease had prepared him for this experience. He asked the charioteer, Chana, what am I seeing? What am I seeing here? Is this going to happen to me as well? Chana said, yes, you too. You too will suffer from sickness, old age, and death. And so he remembered deep in his gut, where that's where our deep questions come from. Like when we start to wonder, like, what's going on here? Who am I? Or what is death? Or what is life? Those are from way, way down. And they may not come as a sentence, but we might just feel it. It's nonverbal even. That's very low in our body. And this happened to Siddhartha. And maybe why you're sitting here too today. Something hitting your gut. Do you remember when you felt the bodily experience that made you think a spiritual path was something you needed to turn to? How will you address it, that feeling? So it was a very shocking and powerful revelation for the overprotected one, that we eventually get old, experience disease. It is the nature of the body. We get old, natural process of life. Everybody dies, but existence continues. And then as he returned to the palace, that last messenger of the spiritual practitioner wearing robes, walking peacefully, very mindfully with each step, he could feel their ease in their walking. And right there, the rebel was born. His mind had a conversion. And he was motivated even more to find out, what the is going on here? And there was no one who could tell him. And so he left his wife and son. And I remember when I saw the Little Buddha, the movie, I went with my parents because I had just entered the monastery and I thought, let's watch the Little Buddha together. And we came out and my dad was really upset and confused about him leaving his family. He says, I don't understand this action, because my dad was very loyal. And I didn't understand it myself at the time, so I was really quiet. I couldn't answer him. I was like, I don't know. I don't know. But he left. And maybe perhaps this was not such a selfish desire to go. A selfish desire, because he knew that his child and his wife would be subject to the same things. And he thought, if I could help them with this suffering, I need to find out what it is. Now, if we can imagine leaving and going to meditate for a long while to achieve liberation, today we might call that spiritual bypassing or shunning one's responsibility. However, it did turn out to be the right choice in a way, because here we are, practicing of the Buddha way. And his wife and his mother and his child all awakened. They practice too. So he hits the road. He says he and Chana takes him out, and he goes to the edge of the forest, and he takes out his sword and he chops off his long hair. He gives Chana all his golds, all his necklaces, and he exchanges robes, the robes of rags, and he gives Chana his robes. And we still follow this symbol is of shaving the head, is a symbol of home leaving and a reminder of my aspiration as a monastic in this world. Every 5 days, shaving the head with a chant that goes, in this drifting, wandering world, it is very difficult to cut off my human ties. Now I cast them away and enter true activity. It is in this way that I express my gratitude. As I shave my head, I renew my vows to live a life of simplicity, stability, selflessness, service, and to accomplish Buddha's way. It comes from that moment that the Buddha left home. So he walked and he joined up with a whole class of primarily men who dropped out of Indian society to find liberation. There's lots of variety of meditation techniques, a lot of teachers, and he investigated many paths. Atheists, materialists, idealists, dialecticians, finally, ascetics. The forest and the marketplace were places teeming alive with sounds of thousands of arguments and opinions. Sound familiar? Not unlike our time. And now we have internet and Twitters and Google, so lots of opinions, and it's like a shooting range, isn't it? With all the opinions and everything. Lots of noise. So he found and began working with some teachers and reported experiences of total bliss, which is still suffering. Because when he came out of these states, it didn't last unless he was in that method. So his peace was only temporarily freed. And his teachers were just amazed at his abilities. Like, he went through all these stages of bliss quite easily, was able to teach. They wanted him to teach, and he said, can't do it. I gotta go. I still did not get to the bottom of it. I'm still suffering. Even in those states, when I come out, same thing. How many of us would do that, right? You get like a big promotion, and you're like the top mucky, and you're like, sorry, doesn't clarify my life up here. I gotta go. He did that. And then he found he wanted the truth, complete freedom, that his mind wasn't dependent on any temporary meditative technique. And he found a group of 5 companions, and he joined them for 6 years, where he drove himself mercilessly, eating only, it said, a single grain of rice a day, pitting mind against body. His ribs stuck out through his wasted flesh, and he seemed more dead than alive. So now he experienced both extremes. He went from gluttony to from attachment to pleasure to radical rejection of all things pleasurable, all extremes. So he spared us what we don't need to go through. Suddenly, close to death, he felt the need for balance. And he made the decision to take more substantial food and abandon asceticism. Why? He was still not free. It was not denying the body is not it. Starving to death wasn't it. He was going to die. So he told his companions, I'm going to take something. This isn't it. And they actually started taunting him. What we would call it today. What?
Shaming.
Shaming. What's the... What? No. I lost the word. When we go after someone and... Hold together now. Anyway. All good. Okay. All of those. They did all of that to him. They accused him, threw insults at him, everything you said, for selling out. Canceled. He was canceled. So he left them. He went down to sit by a river, the Naranjana River, and didn't know what he was going to do because he could barely move. And he was barely sitting upright, and a young girl was coming back from the market, and she saw him. She came upon him passing out, and she prepared some milk that she had and some honey and gave him a bowl of this. And then she returned the next day. He was sitting there, and she brought him more food the next day, yogurt and rice, and little by little, gaining strength. He washed himself and scented himself with herbs. And he said, I'm going to nourish myself, but he went back to that experience as that 8 and 9 year old and said, I'm just going to sit down under a tree and I'm just going to practice until I see this. No more searching. Just going to sit and look it deeply into my mind. Can you imagine that kind of resolve? I mean, we've got two periods and we're like, oh my God, when's this going to end? Sometimes. So we can use that story to kind of like, it's like what we're up against, like this restlessness and this, we want to be free and we want to have clarity in our life and what it takes to face our mind and quiet it, because that's where the troubles are. That's where the troubles come from. So he sat, paid close attention to his mind and body, meditating on the causes of his suffering and confusion. And he just kept returning to his breath. Just keep returning to your breath. When it's all getting like waves, like you feel like you're going under, breath. Just go to your breath. Investigate the sensations from there. Opening awareness, he said, into more compassionate way, not trying to stop any experience, just seeing it arise in the breath, seeing the thoughts arise. Not trying to stop it, seeing how it goes, no matter how pleasant or unpleasant, it arises and disappears, and to treat each moment with love and kindness. He met Mara, Mara mind. Mara is that part of us that says, get up, go home, what are you doing? Pointless. Never mind, I don't want to do this. And go. That's Mara, that part of us that turns us away from what we know is good for us, is life-giving, is wholesome. So we have these aspects in us. The Buddha mind is always with us. That's whole and complete and perfect in all its imperfections. And then this other part that gets tight and narrow and judgmental and critical and and puts us down in ourself. And so he went through all his past lives. Maybe some of us have that experience where we see ways we may have lived before. And how he saw how he was in his heart and mind during those lives, where he was hurting and harming, and where he was trying to have that bodhisattvic vow come through. He saw all of that until that vow was getting stronger and stronger and more refined, as we're doing. We're strengthening our bodhisattva vows, our wanting to be here, to stop our own suffering and those of and that of others. But we see other parts come up in the midst of that, yet we keep at that vow. And then finally, it said, after 6 days, he opened his eyes wide, and upon seeing the morning star, possibly Venus, he roared his lion's roar. Wonders of wonders, I together with this great earth and all living beings at once attained the way. That's his roar that we still have. All beings and this great earth at once. Soon as we get a little bit of opening, that's everybody in that moment. All beings at once. He realized what he had been looking for had never been lost. According to a legend, the Brahma, chief of 3,000 worlds, appeared and requested him to teach. He said, there are those whose eyes have a little smoke covering, a little bit of clouding, and they will see you this truth. So Buddha agreed. So he thought, where do I begin? So he went back to see those two teachers that taught him these states of bliss, and they had actually died during that month. And then he went back to the five ascetics. And when he appeared, they saw him approaching in Deer Park. They decided they would ignore him since he broke his vows. Yet they found something so radiant about his presence, they just found themselves opening up, preparing a seat, getting him tea, washing his feet. It just happened naturally because they felt such love and radiance coming from him. They just opened to it. And that happens to us when we feel that. And then the Buddha turned the Dharma wheel. This is the first turning of the Dharma, where he taught them the Four Noble Truths, which I would like to pass on to you right now. Some of us may know them, but they're good to hear. And this is a way to understand this whole mystery we call life through these four simple, simple but not so simple. Buddha stated that all life, all existence, is characterized by dukkha. And this is the Sanskrit word meaning suffering or unsatisfactoriness due to impermanence. And then there's these three facts within the suffering. There's the suffering of suffering. The moments of happiness have a way of turning to pain, and then we hold on to them. And once passed into memory, they twist the present mind, as I was saying, and the mind makes hopeless attempts to recreate the past. We are born into a realm of constant change, he said, and will lose all that we come in contact with. So the brain attaches solidity to passing births and deaths that we go through all through the day. The instant we become attached, then ego is born. or what appears to be ego. This is really what Buddha would say is empty of a solid self. If it was substantial, we'd have a really tough problem, because nothing would change. Everything, everyone we love and get attached to is impermanent, which is the second fact of existence, of suffering. There is pain we can't do anything about. It's our lack of acceptance of the facts that makes life unsatisfactory. And if that's troubling you, that's good. It means it's real to you. And then the third type of suffering is what Sid called no self. The poor illusion of self then takes on a pitiful aspect when it realizes it's not real. This pitiful aspect is yet another trick so that it can give birth to yet another illusion, that of pity for itself, and on and on and on. This process has no pride and can only be dealt with through refined awareness. We suffer because we crave. And this is the second noble truth, which has to do with why we suffer. We crave, and then we cling once we are close to what we crave. So we crave something, and when we get close to it, we grab it. And then we suffer. So the craving and grasping is the problem. Desires are natural, but craving is painful, which is the extreme aspect of desire. The Buddha said, these truths are dark, but dark is not bad. And then he went on to discuss the third noble truth, which is the cessation of suffering. Sorry, I was a little mixed up here. Let me go back to the second one. Going back to why we suffer. I'll just say a little bit more. So it has to do with what we desire in every moment. Mind creates desire about everything, doesn't it? Desire could be a moving towards or a moving away. So to just be present with what is happening, the mind will do what it does. And what we're learning to do is just to merely be present and watch the mind doing whatever it's doing. There's nothing else for us to do. This is what we're seeing. This is practice. Don't try to change it or embellish it or any of that. Just be there and be aware. The Buddha said, awareness, 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 which is who you are. Awareness. I know we can then ask who is being aware. That will take us back around. Awareness. And the third noble truth is the cessation of suffering. This one has to do with cessation of desire, which of course brings the end. Simple but not easy. He said, this requires that proper effort be placed into this task and the karma of countless lifetimes that has set up conditions so the mind will turn away from conditioned desire. When the mind is still enough, the mind will turn towards the unconditioned. This is what we call nirvana, the unconditioned, the unborn. And then he gave us the road to the unconditioned place. The fourth noble truth is the path. He gave us a precise road map. How kind. What is the precise roadmap? Well, he said, there's 8 elements to it. Simple and straightforward. First, have a right view. And this is a direct result from insight. Not what we think from cognition, but from insight. What comes to us, what we see directly. We must realize deeply that all phenomena are arising and passing. That's having a right view. Realize that there is cessation of all phenomena. Realize the dualistic mind is at the root of ignorance and all suffering. There is no duality there. There is no one and no object to cling to. The second is right attitude. Once you have a right view, he said, you're on the path to liberate your mind from illusion. So having a right view, seeing the arising and passing of phenomena, and then having right understanding. At this point, something keeps pulling you back since you have realized that conditioned existence is illusion. Your attitude has shifted, and now you are concerned with the unconditioned. So the first two then take us to how we conduct ourselves. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So these conditions arise out of our insight. He says, by now you will have realized that the very conditions that condition our karma, how we act from body, mouth, and thought, come from what we actually do in our day-to-day being in the world. The key here is that once you've experienced the insight of impermanence, you will not want to do anything that will cause suffering of any kind. Since now you know that this suffering will merely create more suffering and rebirth for yourself, meaning creating ourself, it's not like rebirth into another life. This life, rebirth moment to moment into a self, meaning the conditions that make you up, which are not separate from all sentient beings. And the last three, right effort, right mindfulness, concentration, and right concentration. He says, make this part of your heart, each one of these that already knows this. And all that you have to do is be still enough to be able to see through the smoke. So Zazen is seeing through the smoke, seeing through what's covering what's already completely clear, that's never been apart from you. Even if you feel like you're so confused, crazy, all of that, there is clarity. There is clarity. That's what we come to trust and reveal more and more. That's where wisdom begins to emerge. So for the next 49 years, Buddha walked through and taught in villages and towns of India, speaking and meeting those in front of him with speech that everyone could understand. He taught the practice of mindfulness, that death was universal, all the different kinds of suffering, and freedom from it. So if you want to look at Buddha's teachings, if it's jealousy, if it's sloth, torpor, whatever is a hindrance, Buddha spoke about it. And you can hear those teachings. And then he died in the town of Kusinagara at the age of 80, having eaten a meal, it's said, of pork and mushrooms, because he didn't reject what was offered to him in his when somebody offered him a meal. And apparently it was tainted. And some of the assembled monks became despondent. Buddha was lying on his side with his head resting on his right hand. And he reminded all his monastics about impermanence. And he advised them to take refuge in themselves and the Dharma, in the Dharma, in themselves and in the Dharma, not in a person, the teaching. And then he asks, what generosity is this? He's dying. He's got dysentery. He's on his side. He says, does anyone have any questions? My God. And of course, I'm sitting there thinking, like, do I want to, like, trouble him with, like, my, like, questions at this point? He's, like, dying, like, the energy to, and everyone said, no. No questions. It's the last time. Buddha's going. Anybody? He said in his final words, now then, I address you all. All compound things are subject to decay. Strive diligently. Be a lamp unto yourself. That's the Buddha's great love. If we can remember that with each other in our darkest times, it's there for us to generate love with every intention. That is the revolution. That's the revolution. Who can do this? Can we generate love with every intention? I mean, I'm working on it. That's a revolutionary way to be. The path of love goes against the stream and is the revolutionary act to abolish greed, anger, and delusion. Out of all the practices, the Buddha said the most direct path to the heart is loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, sympathetic joy. And, you know, even if you think someone doesn't have it, you can see what the power of suffering. It's buried so deep. We may not see it. We can see it. They may not see it. They may not ever find it. They may have done the worst. We may have. And came through to see it. It's there. It's there. So we don't give up. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and knows the path of peace. One teacher wrote, in the myth of the Buddha's enlightenment, he had to sit long days and nights, face off against his ambition, greed, and self-centeredness. It's not a given that we'll sit and change it all. We have to decide. We have to do our human homework, not jump away when it gets uncomfortable or we don't want to know what's happening. Yet we can. We can awaken and keep awakening. Today, Buddha's birthday, December 8th, is about recognizing this. The rest of our lives is about making that possibility our life itself. So, I hope we don't forget this. And the Buddha said, if this wasn't true, and I didn't go through it, I wouldn't be telling you to do it. I hope we can at least do that together as a Sangha here and let it radiate further and further into this Saha world. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.